Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Max Fisher.
Ben is off this week, so Max is jumping in as co-host. It's great to see you. Before joining Crooked Media, Max covered foreign affairs for some obscure niche outlets like the New York Times, the Washington Post, Vox, the Atlantic.
Anywhere Snore.
I'm missing?
Snore.
So some of the biggest names in all of media. He also wrote a great book called The Chaos Machine, which details how social media rewired our brains and, frankly, societies all around the world.
So, this is an amazing introduction. Well, I feel like I should be giving you some props here.
You're a lot better credentialed than I am. I sell underwear. You know, that's what we do
but,
here.
But what underwear it is?
You know that it has evolved over time. Listeners have noticed it has evolved over time. It is really funny to think back. The most scandalous thing in politics was Bill Clinton being asked boxers or briefs at one point.
I had forgotten about that.
And then I'll show you scandalous.
The 90s are just, I know we're going to talk about it, like the incredible prudishness of the 90s, but it's always coming back too.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about like the Tommy Tuberville stuff. It's like 90s throwback.
That guy, bad guy. Pretty good coach, let's be honest. Okay, so got a lot of news today. Updates on the war in Ukraine, the latest in the seemingly endless series of stories based on these classified Pentagon documents that were leaked to the social media site Discord. By the way, how pissed do you think all the other outlets are that the Washington Post seems to have gotten all of these documents and nobody else has?
I have friends who are on both the Post and the New York Times teams. And they, every time one of them has a story, the people on the other paper are like, oh, we had that. Or they have some excuse for like, oh, actually, we had this other story that was better. Or like, they cheated to get that one.
I was going to say, I guess that's better than your editor coming to you every day being like, can we match that? Can we match that?
Oh, there's a lot of that too.
That's probably happening anyway.
But I think they're having a great time. I think they both love it. It's a good natured rivalry.
Okay. It's nice to hear. So there's also election results in Turkey and Thailand. Why the U.S. is in a war of words with South Africa. The aforementioned Senator Tommy Tuberville. Is it Tuberville or Tuberville? Who cares? He's an asshole. Some shorter updates on Sudan, Gaza, China, Title 42. And then, Max, you are our in-house optimist.
Yes.
And you promised to make us feel hopeful. So I'm excited for that.
I have five good news things to make you feel the warm and fuzzies. And also, frankly, the Turkey and Thailand stuff, I'm really excited to get into because it's some pretty encouraging stuff happening in the world.
Yeah, it's big news. And we're going to go guestless today so that Max and I can really spread our wings and flourish here.
It's time to be free.
Yeah, it's time to be free. But before we get to the international news, Max, we have some big Crooked Media news. We have launched our own subscription community, the Friends of the Pod. We really stretched ourselves to get that name. If you join today, you'll get more news and politics content. You get access to weekly bonus content like the subscription-only show Terminally Online, which is very fun and very stupid. A community of friends of the pod on Discord. I've been on the Discord a bunch. It's a very fun, like really good group of people, frankly. And then lots of dumb behind-the-scenes moments, much more. Through Friends of the Pod, you can also have the option of donating part of your monthly subscription directly to Vote Save America so you can help organize voters for 2024 and beyond. So go to crooked.com/friends to learn more and get a 10% discount for a limited time only. Have I sold you, Max?
It's nice to be able to subscribe to something that is also doing something good in the world.
Nice. Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's something that's unique about this place. I think it's really special.
The Vote Save America volunteers are like some of the best people ever. I remember during the pandemic, we did several trainings in a row, and I did the first one, and we were expecting a few thousand. It was like 30,000 people, and I was like crying like a baby, and this Zoom was very pathetic. It was pandemic era, so we were all very emotional.
Sure.
Speaking of emotional, scary night last night for people in Ukraine, Max, because Russia launched a huge barrage of missiles at Ukrainian cities. The good news is that Ukraine's missile defense systems, presumably the new American-made Patriot missile batteries, were able to intercept all of them, including the most advanced hypersonic version of the Russian missiles. President Zelensky, meanwhile, has been on the road. He went to Italy, France, Germany, and the UK. During those visits, he was promised billions in military aid, including a $3 billion commitment from the Germans, and air defense systems, drones, and long-range missiles from the UK. Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, promised to start training Ukrainian pilots on the F-16 fighter jets. Now Ukraine just needs to get some of those jets from someone, but the U.S. is not offering yet.
That, you don't think being on the flight simulator is enough You're fighting the Russians on PlayStation?
Yeah, from like Sega Genesis or whatever. So last December over in the U.S., Congress passed a $48 billion aid package for Ukraine. All but $6 billion of that money has been spent, and many people are worried about getting more out of the Republican House of Representatives. So passing the hat in Europe will be key for Ukraine's ability to keep fighting. Zelensky also met with Pope Francis while in Italy. The Pope has been pushing for peace talks. Interesting to see how that develops. So Max, two questions. First, how much do you think it killed Boris Johnson, the disgraced former prime minister, to see Rishi Sunak getting the cool photo op with Zelensky at Checkers, the prime minister's country house?
I think it did kill him, but Boris was still one of the first in Kyiv, which is, I don't like to hand it to the guy, but you kind of have to hand it to the guy. That was pretty good.
Yeah, true. Two, do we think Zelensky is essentially like waiting to get these commitments before they begin this long-promised spring offensive so that Ukraine knows like literally how much ammunition they can expend?
Right. It's about figuring out what Ukraine can do with their spring offensive, which is their answer to the big Russian offensive over the winter. But it's also, it's much bigger than that. It's about figuring out what is the rest of the war going to look like, because there is, I gather, a sense in Kyiv that while they were still getting an enormous amount of Western support and things like the training on the F-16s, that they probably hit the high water mark.
Yeah.
This winter was probably about the pinnacle of Western support. And now it's going to be this struggle for getting each incremental piece and keeping it going, because this war is really more than it's even a war of front lines or troop movements, it's a war of attrition.
Yeah.
And that is in terms of, you know, artillery shells and tubes, but it's also about money. And that's both sides, I think, are hitting a point where they're not running out, but it's running lower. And that's going to affect how they can fight this war and how long.
It really is like a grinding World War I style, like war of attrition at times, of just sort of how much artillery can you launch per week?
And political attrition, and economic attrition, and industrial attrition. And it's like so much of the war is going to come down to, I think, just like factories and munitions and industrial policy and sanctions on Russia. But of course, behind all of this, and I'm sure coming up in all of his meetings in Europe, are murmurs over whether it's time to start pushing for a peace deal, which is also interlinked with this question of how much support and for how long.
Yeah, that's true. And listeners can't see this, but we're both wearing kind of a Zelensky green shirts today, so in solidarity. Joe Biden goes to the G7 on Wednesday when this show comes out. I'm sure this will be a huge topic of conversation, Ukraine, that is. President Trump was asked about the war in Ukraine during his CNN town hall. Here's a clip.
Do you want Ukraine to win this war?
I don't think in terms of winning and losing. I think in terms of getting it settled so we stop killing all these people and breaking down this country. Now,
what do you... Can I just follow up on that? You said you don't think in terms of winning and losing.
You have to get the, you have
Mr. President,
to get Europe.
Can I just follow up on that? Because that's a really important
excuse
statement
me, let me just follow
made
up.
There. Can you say if you want Ukraine or Russia to win this war?
I want everybody to stop dying. They're dying, Russians and Ukrainians. I want them to stop dying. And I'll have that done. I'll have that done in 24 hours. I'll have it done.
So it is objectively weird that he won't say that he wants the country that was invaded to win the war when the Russians are committing war crimes. I do wonder if that answer would be popular among a broad swath of the electorate, unfortunately. It sounds reasonable.
I'm not a, like, Putin is controlling Trump, like, conspiracy guy. I'm not, like, a P-tape conspiracy guy. But his repeated just rushing to embrace whatever Putin's position is, whatever is driving that, is really striking and clearly part of this. And also, we know he has a grudge against Zelensky because Zelensky would not dig up the, you know, quote-unquote dirt that Trump wanted to, you know, try to defeat
Biden.
So, I mean, I don't know. We went through this in 2015, 2016, where Trump would say things that sounded kind of dovish and sounded about, like, we're going to make peace. And then he would get in and he wouldn't do anything. He wasn't interested. And his only involvement would be to turn the screws on allies to try to extract resources and commitments from them.
Yeah. And meanwhile, there's all this, speaking of turning the screws, there's a lot of pressure on Joe Biden to skip the G7, to stay home and deal with the debt ceiling. I don't think there's any chance he's going to do that. But you know, it's nice of Kevin McCarthy to manufacture a controversy in advance of a global summit to try to embarrass the president.
We love the congressional Republicans just helping out with, you know how much they care about American greatness and American standing in the world. So they're always willing to pitch in for them.
America first, Max. So in public, President Zelensky has shown a lot of restraint. I think we're talking about the war. Mm. He talks about repelling invaders, liberating Ukrainian villages. He has promised repeatedly not to use U.S. weapons to strike inside Russia because of escalation concerns. But a document in the Discord leak of classified Pentagon documents paints a very different picture behind closed doors. It says Zelensky has proposed occupying cities on the Russian side of the border to gain leverage in future negotiations, bombing a Russian oil pipeline to Hungary, and hitting targets inside Russia. Previously, the Post had reported on Ukraine considering attacking Russian-linked forces in Syria. We've also seen all these mysterious drone attacks and things within Russia and Crimea. This intelligence certainly seems to help explain why the U.S. has been so resistant to provide longer-range missiles and fighter jets. Reading this piece, I can't say I'm surprised by Zelensky's frustration or desire to kind of go on offense. I was a little surprised to read about it in the newspaper. Yeah. It is one of the first times I've wondered about the ethics of publication of this document. I'm not criticizing the reporters who did so. It just made me think about it. Zelensky, you know, he may have been considering occupying a Russian village, but he didn't do it, right? And now the Russians could maybe use this to paint him as some sort of aggressor. You have covered foreign affairs for years. You've been in conversations in newsrooms about when or when not to publish a story, what to withhold.
Yeah.
What do you make of the Post decision to go ahead with this one? And what are those conversations like?
So I initially, like you, I saw this and I was like, that's kind of a lot to put in the newspaper because this will have or could have some kind of real ramifications because these are really drastic steps that he's talking about. So, I talked to some people at these papers about what they were thinking and you know, kind of thought back to my own experience with this stuff. And I started to talk myself into being a little bit more comfortable with it. But to answer your question, like, what are the considerations? The first one is always, will publishing this put someone in harm's way? And you'll notice that in the Discord leaks that have been published so far, you're not seeing things like tank movements or, you know, prospective tank movements, even though those are probably in the document. So it stands to reason that there is somewhere a line and things are being held back. But you also have to consider, of course, whether there are other negative real-world ramifications. And that gets a little tricky because then you have to guess at the impact, which means you have to guess what do other people know. And if you think this information would be a surprise to Moscow, I think that's one of the scenarios it would be potentially really dangerous because they could get freaked out by that and they feel like they have to respond, or maybe just the fact that it's now public, they feel like they have to respond. I think it's probably unlikely that Moscow would be shocked by this, partly because if these files are on a Discord server and the Post has them, probably Russia has them too.
That does seem like a big open question, right? I mean, I bet that is the presumption.
Mm, yeah.
But it was like kind of a couple of niche Discord sites. I mean, you know, Russian intelligence was no more destined to be there than U.S. intelligence was.
Right.
So I can't tell.
It's true, and we can't, you know, they can't call up the Kremlin and say, hey, did you know that Zelensky? So you have to do and I've been in situations where you have stuff like this. You have to do like projecting out a few steps and what do we think people know? And I think the thing that a lot of people are upset about that I think actually should not be a consideration here, and I think probably wasn't, was whether this would like hurt Zelensky publicly or in Washington because like Russia could use it against him or his critics could use it against him.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a case for publishing, because if Zelensky is pushing for attacking Russia, that's really significant. And
this is the U.S. intelligence who knows it.
You're right. Yeah. The U.S. intelligence already knows it. I think there's a case for pulling the public into it rather than saying, oh, you know, this could hurt him publicly. And I kind of came around to thinking it's on the edge, but the people who this might lead to react in a negative way that would hurt people probably already knew about it. And if we're talking about like, well, there might be a public backlash against Zelensky, it's like, well, then maybe he shouldn't be suggesting attacking within Russia if he thinks the American public isn't going
to
like that.
Yeah, or maybe it'll continue to encourage him not to do it. By the way, Zelensky must be furious about this. I mean, he said that the White House hasn't called him about these leaks. I don't know, maybe that means the CIA did or somebody else, but boy. Rough couple of weeks for this
guy. That's what I have heard, that he is pretty unhappy with the Post. Yeah.
Yeah. So the other eye-popping Discord leak was about everyone's favorite caterer turned private mercenary group founder, Yevgeny Prigozhin.
Our guy.
Our guy. Prigozhin founded and runs the Wagner Group, which is a private army in Russia that has done a ton of fighting in Ukraine and parts of Africa, especially in Bakhmut lately in Ukraine, where the fighting has been the worst. Prigozhin has been very vocal about his frustration with Russian military leaders. He says they won't provide them with, ammunition, weapons, equipment, etc. Last week, the Washington Post reported that Prigozhin has had ongoing secret communications with Ukraine's military intelligence service, and that at one point, Prigozhin offered to give Ukraine information about Russian troop positions if the Ukrainian military would agree to withdraw troops from the Bakhmut region where the Wagner guys were fighting.
So wild.
Wild.
It was really wild.
Like, so Ukraine apparently didn't take Prigozhin up on the offer because they didn't trust him. I wonder why. But that has not stopped Ukrainian intelligence from taking Prigozhin's calls and even meeting with him in Africa, something that Prigozhin himself confirmed on Telegram. Prigozhin also reportedly encouraged Ukrainian forces to attack Crimea and talked about Russian troop morale being low in certain places. The documents seem to suggest that the Kremlin might know Prigozhin's having these talks, but it's not totally clear. Mm-hmm. Max, when I saw this headline, I thought, start the countdown clock until Prigozhin falls out of a very tall window.
Right.
But maybe it's more muddled. Like, what do you think? Do you think, is he in deep shit here?
So he has often been written about, and Wagner's often been written about, as this like shadowy private army run by Vladimir Putin. And it's never really been quite the case. It's always been this kind of like mercenary rogue actor who happens to align with the Russian state and mm-hmm. to serve things that they need. Because they have real capacity problems, real state capacity problems in Africa and Ukraine, which is, I think, why he's going to stick around. But I think they have known for a long time that he is a total loose cannon who is for himself, because he's been fighting with the Russian Defense Ministry for like a year and like really working to undermine them. And they've been working to undermine him. And I mean, this is a like in some ways a like problem that dates back to medieval Europe, where when you have these private mercenary armies, they act for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. Just last thing on the Discord leaks. Previous reporting has alluded to this, but the Washington Post wrote a long profile of the Discord leaker, this 21-year-old member of the Air National Guard named Jack Teixeira. We learned in this that Teixeira believed he was preparing for a war against Black people, liberals, Jews, and the LGBT community, and that he was amassing an arsenal of guns and other gear for said war. He had all kinds of conspiratorial beliefs. He voiced his support for a number of mass shooters, including the gunman from the Christchurch massacre in New Zealand because the victims were Muslim. The story once again raises serious questions about how this kid got a security clearance, especially since he was suspended from high school for making violent racist threats. And we also learned that he posted more of these documents, the classified documents, on another even larger Discord server. So the universe of stuff that could be out there still seems vast.
It does. It does make me wonder, why was this stuff so widely available to so many people? Although maybe the better question is, why are people this, like, I'm sorry, but psychotic, filling out these roles in the military? And I assume the answer is just because, you know, force exhaustion from 20 years of war, and it's hard to get people to go for these because they're tough jobs.
Yeah, I don't know. This guy, this should not pass a vet. It's really shocking.
Yeah.
Truly.
Plus he's a video gamer, which is, that's the, you know.
Big time gamer. It does sound like, you know, I think he joined the military in 2019 during the pandemic. These Discord groups got really close, maybe got more conspiratorial. Maybe everyone went into their
I mean, I was on group chats during the pandemic. Things got a little dark in there.
Yeah, things got dark. I mean, there was that period of time where it was fun and you were like Zooming with all your high school friends and stuff. And then by like 6 months in, I was like, I can't do another Zoom.
Yeah. Once at like 9 months, once we started becoming white nationalist insurgents, the group chat was just also, I should say, I was kidding about he's a video gamer, so therefore he's bad. The gamers don't come after me. I'm pro gamers.
We're all pro gamers here. Okay, so enough about this guy, or at least until we get to the Tommy Tuberville section. So the eyes, the world eyes of the world, it doesn't quite work, we're on Turkey this weekend, where President Tayyip Erdogan faced his most difficult election in years against an opposition leader named Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Erdogan got about 49% of the vote on Sunday. Kılıçdaroğlu got about 45%. Neither of them got 50%, so they go to a runoff on May 28th. Erdogan will likely benefit from the fact that this is now a head-to-head matchup, whereas before there was, in particular, another far-right nationalist candidate who got about 5%. Presumably those voters would go to Erdogan. Erdogan is seen as politically vulnerable, or was seen as politically vulnerable, because of the government's botched response to the recent earthquake that killed at least 50,000 people in Turkey, and because Erdogan's economic mismanagement led to record inflation. Many people around the world are also, I think, understandably quite worried about Erdogan's increasingly dictator-light kind of tendencies.
Yeah, dictator medium, yeah, I think you could say, yeah.
The vote itself seems to have been free, but not necessarily fair, because Erdogan, to your point, has so much control over the media. So Max, Turkey is a NATO member. They're part of the G20. The U.S. and Turkey have worked together closely on a lot of issues. I remember going to Turkey with Obama in 2009, for example. It was surprising to me to see news reports about how the United States was openly cheering for Erdogan to lose, given Erdogan's likely reaction if he won. Can you help listeners understand why people are so eager to see Erdogan go? And I guess why the average listener should care about who the hell's running Turkey?
So this is, I would argue that this is, regardless of how the second round turns out, the most important election this year. Is that crazy, do you think?
No, tell me why.
So the Erdogan story is, I think, such a fascinating one. And it like tells us how we got here. And I think it also tells us a lot about how the world has changed over the last 20 years and how we went from this era of optimism to one of a little bit more pessimism. Because when he first came into office in 2003, being the mayor of Istanbul, he was widely seen as a good guy, as this like force for democracy and progress. And Turkey was coming out of this long period of repression and on and off military rule. And Erdogan was seen as representing this like new order of elections and popular legitimacy. And he expanded social services. He lifted a bunch of the country out of poverty. He expanded some personal freedoms. He tripled GDP per capita, which is wild. Think about how much you would like Joe Biden if he tripled your like net worth and your bank
that'd
account.
Be cool. Yeah, let's
you
do
would
that.
Like it. Yeah, and he modernized Turkey and these cities with these like huge, huge construction boom and construction projects. And he was pro EU. He was pro Arab Spring when he was involved in, and he was kind of remaking Turkey into this new regional power in the Middle East. And like you probably remember the like era when we were like all kind of excited about Erdogan.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly, I mean, you know, I think it was Obama's first trip or one of his earliest trips included a stop in Turkey. Hmm. My main memory from that trip was the plane breaking and us getting stuck there overnight. So we actually got to do cool tour stuff. And also walking around the then Turkish president's home, President Gül, with my colleague at the time, Mike Hammer, who was another NSC spokesman, who's now the special envoy for the Horn of Africa. So he went on to bigger and better things. But
he wishes he was potting. Come on.
Yeah. But that's an interesting point, because at the time, the president was a ceremonial position.
And Erdogan was the prime minister.
Erdogan's the prime minister. Yeah. And then Erdogan changed the rules or changed the constitution to give the president power. And now he's the president.
Right. And the like, So the 2008 is kind of a fascinating. I think that's kind of the high watermark of like Erdogan as this like democratic reformer and this modernizer, and everybody loves him. And things started to really turn 10 years in 2013. You probably remember like the big Gezi Park protest, this like park in Istanbul.
Yes.
It started as this environmentalist rally against overdevelopment in the big cities, but became eventually this wider backlash among the urban middle class, which has always been kind of Erdogan skeptical, over what they saw as him creeping towards rolling back some of the freedoms that he had once championed. And Erdogan cracks down really violently on these protests. It's actually kind of a little bit like echoes of Moscow 2011, 2012. Mm. Some of the protesters get hit with these bogus sedition charges and like 20-year prison sentences. And this is kind of like the start of Erdogan's slide into this like elected strongman model that we now see so many of in the world. And Turkish society starts polarizing. But then a big step comes in 2016 when a bunch of rogue military officers attempt a coup. It fails, but Erdogan, out of like opportunism or paranoia or probably both, launches these like purges. Just 77,000 people are arrested, mostly on these like vague charges of political disloyalty. He expels hundreds of thousands of civil servants from the government, so guts his own government, announces these emergency laws, it takes over the courts, he purges universities and civil society, and he starts to become like a little wacky.
Yeah.
You remember these like neo-imperial ceremonies he would hold, like dressed up like a 19th century, like Ottoman imperial. And he would like rant, we start with like conspiracy theories. People would meet with him and say there's something off about this guy. And Turkey starts to like feel like a police state, started backsliding really hard in the opposite direction. And then he, like you said, he blows up the economy because he's fired all the technocrats from his government, and he's right. doing all this cronyism with these like guys in construction. He's fantastically corrupt, which is a big part of why when Turkey is hit by this big earthquake in February, all of this construction that he'd overseen turns out to be just insanely substandard because it was all through corruption and bribes. It collapses, kills 50,000 people, maybe a lot more. But the, like Erdogan is also, he's terrible for Turkey, which matters because 85 million people live there. And it's also one of the most beautiful countries in the world, I think.
Yeah,
but
truly.
It's bad for Europe and the Middle East because Turkey is really involved in both. And he's turned himself into this kind of like geopolitical spoiler. He's getting close with Putin. But I think more than anything else for me, what matters about this guy losing and why it is so important that he lose is that he really embodies this new global trend of the like elected leader who hardened into the strongman in office, which is like arguably one of the biggest threats we face in the world. And like he's a leading case of it. Orban in Hungary, the Philippines and India, and like Trump in the United States. Like these guys are like all of one piece. And I think that's why basically all of the democratic world is lined up in wanting to see Erdogan and what he represents defeated, which voters got really close to.
So close. Man, that 2016 coup attempt, I'll never forget watching that, because I think you had fighter jets flying around the Capitol. Yeah. I think Erdogan was FaceTiming into the state TV network from his plane, delivering a message of like, go to the streets, you know, fight them. But yeah, I mean, he did slide into autocracy, and you've watched the U.S. and really all Western countries kind of try to recalibrate in real time. I mean, the U.S. recently agreed to sell Turkey F-16 upgrades, but they're also blocking Sweden from joining NATO. Turkey is, right? So there's, you could push and pull constantly with this guy.
He's not great. And he's if he gets another 4 or 5 years, he's just going to get worse.
Yeah, he'll probably die in office at this point.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of at this point where, like, I think it's easy to look at a strongman like this and say, well, oh, he's a dictator, so of course he's going to win the election. But the new, like, way that this electoral strongman works is there's usually a period of, like, 10 or 20 years where they're slowly consolidating power, where they still need elections. And, like you said, the vote itself looks like it was probably fair. Like, the opposition party was watching the polls. They were watching the ballots come in. They say it's fair, but it's the other 364 days of the year when, you know, the state media is only covering him and ignoring the opposition. You don't hear about the opposition because civil society has been gutted, and there's this like climate of fear.
If you love Positive America and want more of my political analysis, you should subscribe to my newsletter, The Message Box. I'm Dan Pfeiffer, former senior advisor to Barack Obama, and in Message Box, I break down what's actually happening in politics and what it's going to take to beat Donald Trump and MAGA. If you follow every poll and every twist and turn in the campaign, Message Box is for you. This isn't just hot takes. Every edition delivers clear analysis, behind-the-scenes insight, and practical strategy you can actually use, whether you're working on a race, organizing your community, or just trying to win the argument in your group chat. So if you're listening to this, hit pause, go to your browser, and head to crooked.com/yeswedan, because I have a special offer for Crooked Media fans. You'll get 20% off the Message Box for an entire year. So go to crooked.com/yeswedan. If you love Positive America and want more of my political analysis, you should subscribe to my newsletter, The Message Box. I'm Dan Pfeiffer, former senior advisor to Barack Obama, and in Message Box, I break down what's actually happening in politics and what it's going to take to beat Donald Trump and MAGA. If you follow every poll and every twist and turn in the campaign, Message Box is for you. This isn't just hot takes. Every edition delivers clear analysis, behind-the-scenes insight, and practical strategy you can actually use, whether you're working on a race, organizing your community, or just trying to win the argument in your group chat. So if you're listening to this, hit pause, go to your browser, and head to crooked.com/yeswedan, because I have a special offer for Crooked Media fans. You'll get 20% off the Message Box for an entire year. So go to crooked.com/yeswedan.
Speaking of frenemies, Max, the U.S. is now in this war of words with South Africa. The backstory is recently, the U.S. ambassador to South Africa did a press conference in Pretoria, in the capital, and accused the South African government of providing weapons and ammunition to Russia for use in Ukraine. The evidence was there was this cargo ship that was linked to a sanctioned company that secretly docked at a naval base near Cape Town in December and got loaded up with something. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa denied the allegations, but also said he would investigate them, what was happening at his own naval base. So that didn't inspire confidence. But then sort of as this shitstorm is fully kicked up, the Russian government this morning, I believe, or whatever time zone it was on, announced that the head of South Africa's army was in Moscow for meetings.
Conspicuous timing.
Yeah, the South African government said, whoa, this meeting was planned in advance of, you know, you guys releasing these allegations, which I would argue was kind of the whole problem and the point.
Right.
So Ramaphosa also suggested that Vladimir Putin might visit South Africa in August for the BRICS meeting. So, you know, the official South African position on the war in Ukraine is neutrality.
Doesn't feel so neutral.
It feels less neutral, right? I mean, what do you think's going on here? Is this... Look, is this the U.S. reaping what it sowed and no one trusts us and our intelligence after Iraq 20 years later? Is, you know, are South Africa playing some dirty games? Like, where do you land?
I think that this is something that is really specific to South Africa, and more specific than, like you're saying, the kind of generalized distrust of the U.S. or the West, or the, like we've talked about a lot on the show, the generalized global South skepticism of the Ukrainian side in the war. You were in the White House in 2011. Do you remember the weird role that South Africa played in the Libyan civil war and the diplomacy around the civil war?
Barely.
So even after everyone in the entire world had lined up against Muammar Gaddafi's government because he was fighting this Arab Spring rebellion, like everyone in the African Union had lined up against him, all of the other Arab states had lined up against him. It was not just a Western thing. South Africa was the one holdout where they were still siding with him publicly. Even after he fell, they were blocking at the UN recognition for the new rebel government. And when you talk to people in South Africa, people who knew South Africa, they would say this is all about the anti-apartheid movement, because Gaddafi had been, and this will come back to Russia, had been a huge backer of the anti-apartheid struggle personally and financially. And the thing about the South African government, it is still full of people who personally fought in that.
Right, yeah.
So it's not even just like, oh, we owe like a national debt. It's like, these are people who personally benefited from that and personally think that the entire South African nation as they know it owes a debt to Gaddafi. That's and that is really true of South Africa's relationship with Moscow too. Huh. The Soviet Union was, in the 70s and 80s, a really big backer of the anti-apartheid movement. Now, it was all geopolitics, of course, much as the U.S. played cynical
Cold
geopolitics.
War, yeah.
Right. But they were training. They would bring anti-apartheid leaders, including Thabo Mbeki, who later became a South African president, to Moscow for training. They got really involved in this proxy war in Angola that humiliated the South African government. So my sense is that this is a continuation of this belief that, like, we South Africa as a nation and what we believe in really owes a debt to Russia. And those are, you know, they came for us, or they helped us out when no one else would.
Well, that is fascinating context. I mean, I wonder what this investigation will find about the ship at the port and what was loaded up into it. I mean, it does seem likely that, you know, if this was a sanctioned, you know, Russian entity's ship, that the U.S. was probably watching it for a long time and knows where it came from and knows where it went and maybe has a good sense of what was loaded up on it.
Shocked, yeah. Did you see that South Africa is leading a bunch of a pan-African diplomatic and peace initiative to Europe?
I did see that.
It's kind of funny.
Yeah, I hope it works.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Oh, no, it's great. I'm all for it. It just, you have to appreciate the irony of a pan-African diplomatic initiative to the war-torn European continent to help the, like, Europeans get it together, which they need, which, you know.
I know exactly what you're saying. So, Max, big news in Thailand.
Huge news in Thailand.
We don't talk about Thailand enough here.
Thailand is fascinating. It's a fascinating place. It's much more developed, middle class, democratic than people know. And this election is huge. I'm really jazzed about it.
Okay, so we got this progressive Move Forward party. Mm-hmm. They trounced two military-aligned parties currently running the government, the coalition running the government. I think the coalition in charge got like 15% of the vote or something like that.
Yeah, did not do so well.
Move Forward, this new party, has promised to reform the military, reform the economy, and even to reform laws against criticizing Thailand's royal family, which is a big deal. Mm-hmm. The Move Forward party grew out of these pro-democracy protests that started in 2020. In 2014, a military coup ousted the elected government at the time, And this is only the second election since then. The other opposition party took second place in the most recent elections. Neither has enough seats in parliament to form a government outright, so they got to cut a deal and form a coalition. Max, help us understand why you think this is such a big deal and why you are more optimistic than I am that these civilian leaders won't get, you know, pushed aside or imprisoned like, you know, democratically elected governments in Myanmar, for example.
Sure. So let me give you the, like, 90-second history of Thailand and how we got, because I just think it's a fascinating story. So Thailand has always stood out from the rest of Southeast Asia. It's wealthier per capita. It has a big middle class. It has these highly developed democratic politics. But it also has more military coups in the modern era than any other country in the world. And it's, like, not even close. They have, depending on you count it, 13 or 14 coups in the last, which is
that's a
huge number. And it, the military sees itself as playing this very unusual role in Thai society, as, and I'm not endorsing this, as safeguarding Thai democracy, which weirdly they actually helped to bring about in the first place. Their first coup in the 30s was to replace the absolute monarchy with a constitutional monarchy. Mm-hmm. And what happens is the military ever since steps in basically any time it thinks political turmoil is getting out of control. So mass protests, military coup. Political deadlock, military coup. And typically it hands power back to an elected government within a year or so. But this system, which was never great, started to, hot take. Don't love regular military coups. Started to kind of spiral out of control, and the coups got way more common starting about 20 years ago. And there are two reasons for this. One is that the Thai monarchy, which in theory is supposed to act as this kind of problem-solving mediator in politics, became much, much weaker. The king was getting really old and probably senile. Then he died in 2016.
Right.
His son took over, who is super unpopular, which I can say because Crooked does not have an office in Thailand. But if we did, I would have to be really careful about saying that.
You get like 15 years.
You could actually go to jail.
How do you say Le Majeste? Is that how you say this laws?
Les Majeste?
I don't know, something like that. Yeah. Something French, something.
I got pretty close to C's in all of my French classes.
Not my strength either.
Between the two of us, we'll nail this one, yeah.
Anyway, don't go to Thailand and insult the king.
Until these reforms get instituted. Right. So the second reason that Thai politics started to spiral out of control 20 years ago is they became super, super polarized. For a long time, the country's urban middle class, who are mostly in the south of the country, pro-establishment, pro-monarchy, had dominated politics. But then 2001, this guy who's really important in Thailand, named Thaksin Shinawatra, comes along and he starts organizing the rural poor, who are mostly in the north and who are actually a slight majority of the population, to get involved in politics. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm calling Shinawatra like a hero of the people. He's this like billionaire businessman. He's kind of an opportunist. And he has a little bit of a flavor of the like electoral strongman populist we were talking about. And when he becomes prime minister in 2001, he starts amassing power for himself, freaks out the political establishment, who fight him at every turn. And this sets off this cycle of unrest, protests, counter-protests. There'd be a coup, then Shinawatra or like one of his many family members would win power again in the next election, and then there'd be more unrest and then another coup. Society gets more and more polarized, and that leads the military to this coup that you mentioned, the most recent one in 2014, to hold on to power longer than usual. And it directly rules until 2019 when it hands over power to a civilian government under this new constitution that makes it much easier for the military-backed party to win, although the party did also get a plurality of votes in the 2019 election because Thai society is still really polarized and there's still a lot of skepticism about like straight democracy. So it looked like this election, this most recent one on Sunday, was going to be a repeat of 2019 with the military-backed party doing well. Right. Thai voters don't trust each other, really polarized, but that's not what happens. This progressive party move forward kind of comes out of nowhere and wins this huge, like you mentioned, 36% of the vote, which is huge when you have like 10, 15 parties running, way more than any other party. And the party that comes in second is actually Thaksin Shinawatra's party, which is Phu Thai. And the military-backed party is a really distant third. And this is huge, I think, for two reasons, both of which I think if you're an American, you should actually like be really excited about, encouraged about. The first is that the Progressive Party is this new third force that breaks the polarization in Thai politics. Mm. And it gives Thai voters, after 20 years of this like demographic division, really sharp division and distrust, a way to come together. And the second is the thing that it brings them together under, that they're coming together for, is democracy.
Yeah.
Is to say, whatever, you know, whatever economic, whatever religious divides we have this national consensus for we want to fight the military in the United States, it might be something else that we're fighting, in order to put democracy first and to protect democracy through this vehicle of the Move Forward Party. And I think these are both just amazing developments that are worth cheering and worth getting excited about if you live in a country, say the United States, where polarization and rising sympathy for authoritarianism, like in Thailand in recent years, is getting higher.
Yeah, and feels scary. I mean, so we should say it is, you know, the Constitution is still kind of rigged in favor of the
super
military.
Rigged.
So
yeah.
They have a unelected 250 seat Senate that is chosen entirely by the military. You have to get a combined number of seats to form a government, so that sort of stacks the deck against you, but hopefully it's possible here. But to your point, I mean, if we're, you know, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative, as Joe Biden would say, in neighboring Cambodia, Prime Minister Hun Sen once again disqualified the country's main opposition party from running in the next election over ridiculous paperwork issues. Basically, they said, where is your founding documents?
Nonsense.
And the opposition party doesn't have the founding documents because when the government raided their office, they probably burned them up or took them or something back in the day.
So the Progressive Party in Thailand actually got disqualified under similar nonsense made up stuff in 2019. So I think the fact that the military, you hate to give the Thai military credit for allowing elections to go forward because of course they should. So I'm not saying they did because they're good guys, but I think they felt pressure and felt like they had to allow elections to go forward. And the sense among analysts is that they will probably extract some concessions from the political parties before they give them the rubber stamp to say, okay, you can form a government. Probably they won't change the Lese Majeste laws or the Lese Majeste laws or whatever we're calling them. But it seems like the Thai military is so allergic to unrest and protests and to being seen as a partisan actor. I think it's very likely they'll let it go forward and then we'll probably see a change in the constitution. The big question is whether this new coalition of the Progressive Pro-Democracy Party and the populist Shinawatra Party can create a kind of new coalition in favor of democracy to avoid this cycle that Thailand has fallen into so many times before. But I know you are a little bit maybe less sunnily optimistic than I am. So what are you thinking?
Listen, I just worry about the role that the guys with the guns play in all of these cases, whether it's Thailand, Sudan, which we'll talk about in a little bit, you know, Myanmar, Burma, whatever you want to call it. So fingers crossed.
Yeah.
I will, I'm going to stay hopeful here.
Yeah. I will say that the Thai military does not have the record of the Sudanese and the Myanmar military of, you know, mass violence and, you know, shooting up huge numbers of people. And I don't think they want to rule in the way that the Sudanese military and the Myanmar military. I think they want to have it. They're like, it's kind of like when Egypt's military took over in 2011. They wanted to get rid of Mubarak. They didn't actually want to run the country. And they like threw away that hot potato pretty much as quickly as they could.
And then took it back again.
That is a good point.
Look, we'll see. We'll see. Hope springs eternal.
If you love Positive America and want more of my political analysis, you should subscribe to my newsletter, The Message Box. I'm Dan Pfeiffer, former senior advisor to Barack Obama, and in Message Box, I break down what's actually happening in politics and what it's going to take to beat Donald Trump and MAGA. If you follow every poll and every twist and turn in the campaign, Message Box is for you. This isn't just hot takes. Every edition delivers clear analysis, behind-the-scenes insight, and practical strategy you can actually use, whether you're working on a race, organizing your community, or just trying to win the argument in your group chat. So if you're listening to this, hit pause, go to your browser, and head to crooked.com/yeswedan, because I have a special offer for Crooked Media fans. You'll get 20% off a Message Box for an entire year. So go to crooked.com/yeswedan.
Don't you wish everything was more rewarding? With Rakuten, almost everything is. You can earn cash back on those new shoes you've been wanting. You can save on the next trip you book. You can cash in on groceries. Just join. Shop your favorite brands and save. Target, Instacart, Expedia, Macy's, Sephora, CVS. The list is long. Save online, in-store, and at over 22,000 restaurants. And when it's time to redeem those rewards, get your money exactly how you want it. Choose PayPal, check, Bilt points, or cash out with gift cards. So go ahead, take a trip, fill a cart, order dessert. Rakuten is a world of rewards. Join today for free. Go to Rakuten.com or get the app. That's Rakuten.
Back to the U.S., Max, because, you know, look, democracy is the best system we got, but it's imperfect. And one of the reasons is there is, in Washington at least, there's a constant brutal battle to be named the dumbest United States senator. And Wisconsin's Ron
Johnson. It's a tight race.
Yeah, Wisconsin's Ron Johnson. He's usually out in the lead.
Yep.
But Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville has been coming for the crown lately. Let's let him explain why in this clip.
You mentioned the Biden administration trying to prevent white nationalists from being in the military. Do you believe they should allow white nationalists in the military?
Well, they call them that. I call them Americans.
So we, a little while ago, talked about Jack Teixeira, who seemingly was a sort of Christian white nationalist preparing for a race war while in the Air Force, leaking tons of documents. So it seems like it is a problem that, Senator Tuberville should know about.
Yeah.
The exchange itself came in response to questions about why Senator Tuberville is holding up the confirmation of literally all military nominations over the Pentagon's abortion policy. So the Pentagon provides support for service members and their dependents who need abortion services but live in states like Alabama, where abortion is illegal. Even Mitch McConnell is on the record saying that this blanket military obstruction is a bad idea, so are a number of his colleagues. And speaking of which, President Biden is reportedly considering reversing the Trump administration's proposal or plan to move the U.S. Space Force Command from Colorado to a base in Alabama, in part because of Alabama's total abortion ban. So great work, Senator. You are holding up the entire U.S. military. You are preventing your state from getting jobs and a big influx of money because you are an idiot. Well done.
I mean, it's something that I feel like we have seen from Republican culture warriors since the 90s, where it's they're presenting it as it's like, oh, we have to protect the sanctity of the military and our fighting boys from the woke liberal Democrats. But in fact, what they are doing is, first of all, nothing that they are calling a threat to the military is actually a threat to it. I mean, that's, you know, we found that over and over again. They say, oh, no, if you allow gays in the military, then we won't be able to fight. You know what? They can fight just fine. They're doing just fine.
Before that, women. Before that, African-Americans.
Exactly. Right, right. And then that he is at the same time, in fact, kneecapping the actual military that he claims to be serving. It actually, like, I don't want to get hyperbolic with this, but this is something that was pretty common in like mid-century fascist European politics. I'm not saying that he is a European style fascist, but it was this common culture war thing to present the cultural sanctity of the military as this thing that had to be protected because the armed forces were the embodiment of the soul of the nation, and they had to be the like most traditionalist version of citizens that we could possibly imagine. So they would fight these crazy culture wars over who could be in the military and what they could be, because it's a way to advance this like right-wing nationalist politics.
Yeah, and look, I remember it was not long ago, maybe a year and a half, where like people like Ted Cruz were retweeting these Russian propaganda videos for military recruitment for their military and being like, oh no, if the woke US military ever goes up against these guys, we're cooked. And then, you know, the Ukrainian military delivers, you know, 100,000 casualties to them. So
It's amazing to see how readily they will buy into the Russian propaganda that because Russia is a ultra conservative dictatorship, therefore the military is real manly men, and that is, I guess, what matters to them in terms of having an effective fighting force is whether they have like the right cultural cues.
Yeah, it's just the dumbest thing in the world.
It's quite dumb.
A couple quicker things before we get to the optimism. So last week, Ben and I talked about concerns that there would be this drastic increase in the number of migrants attempting to cross the southern border after the expiration of Title 42, which is a Trump-era policy that allowed the U.S. government to use public health concerns to expel basically everyone trying to enter the country. But instead, Max, the exact opposite has happened. The U.S. Border Patrol agents have seen a 50% reduction in attempted crossings. The Secretary of Homeland Security says the reduction is likely because under Title 42, migrants knew they would get expelled, yes, but then they could just try again and again and again and again until they got in. Now you face much harsher penalties, including a 5-year ban potentially on reentry and maybe even criminal penalties. So, you know, Max, I assume the border crossing numbers will fluctuate over time. They always have. They always will. They'll probably increase for a variety of reasons. But it is kind of remarkable how wrong the conventional wisdom was here, including from Joe Biden himself. Sure. This wasn't like us blaming the media.
Yeah.
I'm curious what you think happened. Like, was this just brilliant expectations management, something else?
I mean, there's been a few changes in Central America itself, which of course, that's where things actually happen that lead people to flee for the United States or not to flee for the United States. El Salvador has arrested basically all of the male population of certain adult ages in this like a really extreme effort to crack down on gangs, which has been effective at reducing violence, but is not so great if you are one of the many, many people arrested. Mexico, of course, is at the United States' behest doing a lot to stop migrants from reaching the border in the first place. I mean, to me, all of this, you know, the numbers go up, the numbers go down. We change out one policy for another. To me, it feels like it's all basically the same policy, which is extinguishing the right of asylum in the United States. And the like, it's taking place in a way now that is a little bit more palatable and I think leads to fewer ugly incidents. But we've still basically killed the right to asylum.
Yeah, I mean, asylum laws were designed to comply with international laws and standards.
Sure, and U.S. law.
In U.S. law. I think the system has gotten overwhelmed and it's not working.
It's true.
And Trump and now President Biden have moved away from it and instead are creating these country-by-country humanitarian parole numbers where they'll allow people in under certain conditions and they'll expel others. And I totally understand those who think it's wrong and believe that, you know, we're basically shredding up asylum law and rights in real time, but also the frustration for people in government who feel like, well, the status quo isn't working for anyone, so we need to do something else. I also, talking to some people in the administration, one of the things they point out is that we talk all the time about, like, you know, what Congress is doing, Title 42, administration messaging, but they say that the biggest problem they have is disinformation in like Telegram and WhatsApp groups from smugglers. Yeah, who are just constantly, there's an industry of trying to bring people up and bait them across and get paid.
Oh, I see. I see.
And create these, you know, incredibly dangerous conditions. So yeah, I don't know, we'll keep an eye on this one, but it is kind of amazing that it just, you know, you had hundreds of cameras down on the border waiting for this.
The crisis.
Right. And in fact, right-wing outlets were using old photos from other countries to sort of present the image they wanted.
You're absolutely right that the status quo was not working. But I think that it is, I don't know, it kind of underscores where we are, that the thing that we are thinking about is the crisis at the border or the absence of a crisis of a border rather than, you know, why we have these international legal obligations to asylum. Because it's not just to be nice, although it is also like good to use your giant super wealthy country to help people who need it, but it's also for the stability of the international system. And the U.S. has been tearing up this right since the early 1990s, along with a lot of help from the Europeans and the Australians, and that has an effect worldwide because then other countries follow. And when you see asylum breaking down worldwide as it is under American leadership, that affects huge numbers of people and it affects many conflict zones around the world that become more unstable as a result.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, and viewing it as a crisis, that's always this immediate thing that is happening now and not the result of long-term systemic changes or in many cases wars that the United States started or was a part of in places like Afghanistan or the Arab Spring or the climate crisis. It has to be a global and systemic effort to figure out the next thing.
Right. I don't want to lay it all on Biden's feet. I mean, I kind of think our guy Obama was the like basically the only one who had any years in office where he was not actively eroding the right to asylum.
It's, I don't know, probably. I mean, there was a lot of deportation happening. There was an effort, you know, that kind of died in 2013 to get a comprehensive immigration reform package done.
Right.
And then it just turned into Republican demands for border security.
Yeah.
And the American people's opinions turned pretty harshly against welcoming people.
Right. It is true. There's not a popular consensus in favor of asylum whatsoever.
No, it's probably the worst polling issue for Democrats, I think, out there. Awful. We'll keep talking about it, though. In Israel, the Israeli government and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad militant group reached a ceasefire after 5 days of fighting. It killed 33 Palestinians and two people in Israel. This round of fighting started when Israel bombed three PIJ commanders in Gaza, killing them along with 10 civilians. The PIJ responded with rocket fire, and the fighting continued until the Egyptian government stepped in to help broker a ceasefire. The good news, you know, for the millions of people in Gaza, for hundreds of thousands of Israelis who have been terrified for the last week, is that there's this pause. But, you know, big swaths of Gaza are once again leveled. They probably won't be rebuilt as they weren't the last time.
Because they can't bring in concrete.
Yeah, there's still a blockade. There's no process in place to resolve all the underlying tensions that feed this tension in the fighting. Hamas didn't get involved in this round. That is seen as a good thing. It probably helps shorten the timeline of the war itself. But, you know, it's just a reprieve, really.
Yeah. I am reminded of an Israeli expression that is sometimes used for their policy towards Gaza, which I once got into a long conversation with an editor over whether we could even put it in the paper because it's so horrible. Mowing the lawn.
Awful.
It's really right. And that is the policy. And the policy is that you don't fix the underlying issues because you don't want to and you don't have to if you're Israel. You build up a wall to insulate yourself from the consequences. So all those consequences fall on people in Gaza. Occasionally conflict springs up, and then the mowing the lawn is you go in and, or you don't go in, you launch missiles, whatever, drone strikes, and kill what you think is the appropriate number of people to stop the violence.
Yeah. And expend their munitions.
Right, and expend their munitions,
Not good, not good. For some little good news, for those who are worried about tensions between the U.S. and China, here's a sliver of good news, Max. Jake Sullivan, President Biden's national security advisor, had 2 days of meetings with his Chinese counterpart in Vienna, Austria. They met for about 8 hours. No one's suggesting this was like a big breakthrough, but hopefully this, you know, relieved a bit of pressure that's been building up since the spy balloon incident and other things. Still no planned phone call or meeting between Biden and President Xi Jinping of China yet.
I'm really glad that you brought this up, because this is the, like, maybe the most important thing that is happening in the entire world are the escalating tensions between the U.S. and China. There's not, like, other than the balloon or some stuff, there's not like a single moment to draw attention to it. But if you talk to, like, people who are involved in foreign governments or people who are, you know, policy analysts around the world, they are freaked out about this. And U.S. allies in Europe and especially in Asia have been screaming for months that they are really, really worried about how bad it's getting, about how zero sum it is, how black and white, and about where it's going to go, because no one seems to have an off-ramp for it. Like, people will go to China and they'll talk to policy people there and they'll say, it's getting much worse, much faster than we think. And so even if this is just a, like, Jake Sullivan dipping his toe in the water, maybe we have a conversation about having a conversation about potentially easing things back, that's great.
Yeah, I'll take it too.
Yeah.
I'm there too. Anything to just chill out, especially when the consensus to Washington is just hawkishness.
Right.
Bipartisan, everybody.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's not a lot of good news from Sudan. The civil war there has been going on for about a month now. The Sudanese military is fighting a paramilitary group called the RSF. They used to be allies and friends, and now they are at war. I've seen reports now that over 1,000 people have been killed. I'm sure that's an undercount. The UN says 200,000 Sudanese have left the country. Another 700,000 have been internally displaced by the fighting. So we just wanted to update folks on that, because we were leading with it for several weeks, but it's just sort of status quo awful at the moment.
Yeah.
So, that's bad news. Max, you're our in-house optimist here. You said you had some good stories.
I do. I wanted to use our time together, both you and me and the listeners, to come up with five, which is not even hard to find, five really good things happening in the world that can make you feel good about being on planet Earth right now.
Great.
So I'm going to run through them. Okay. Number one, the Greek economy. Remember when that used to be a punchline or the most horrifying thing you've ever heard for many, many years? Thriving. Thriving.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either. Well, until I read about it. 6% GDP growth last year has been consistently outpacing the Eurozone average, and even double at some points. Had a big rise in trade, big rise in tourism. It's had a ton of foreign direct investment from Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Pfizer. Educated Greeks who left during the financial crisis are returning in big numbers. And remember, it was like the Greek financial crisis 13 years ago, it wasn't just bad. It was like catastrophic. Like, the country was cratering.
For people who are listening thinking, why do I give a shit about Greece? I can't tell you how many meetings I sat in with Barack Obama, where people were, his economic advisors and national security staff were talking to him about the Greek debt crisis and the risk of default.
It was going to pull down the entire EU.
We thought it could crater the global economy again right after the financial crisis. You had the Germans and the French demanding that they cut their way out of the problem. Meanwhile, the Greeks owed a lot of money to French and German banks, but that didn't really get talked about. So yeah, the fact that Greece is on its feet is a huge deal.
Right. And the Greek far right that had been profiting from that so long is not doing so well anymore. And they're having elections next week, and it's either probably going to be the incumbent government or left-wing Syriza is going to win.
There we go. Show Italy how to do it.
Okay. Here's good news from a place you might not be expecting it. Iraq.
Okay.
Every year since 2003, there has been a big wave of militant attacks during Ramadan. This year was the first year in 20 years it did not happen. There was no mass violence by militants.
Is there a sense of why?
Let me give you a quote from a military blogger named Joel Wing. The insurgency, which he refers to the Islamic State and all the other insurgent groups that have been operating there for so long, the insurgency is a shell of its former self, and it is isolated in the rural, mountainous, and desert regions of Iraq, where it has become irrelevant.
Even the like sort of Iranian-linked Shia militias that are kind of close to the government?
I mean, a lot of them probably went and fought and died in Syria.
That's true.
Yeah. No, things are, I mean, I'm not going to say things are amazing there, but the just wrenching security crisis that Iraqis have lived with for, you know, for many of them their entire life.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's over, but what was this marker of how horrible it was is looking a lot better. And, you know, I will be crossing my fingers that the country will consolidate that and turn that into some political progress too.
That's great.
Here's one from India, another place that usually makes me incredibly depressed to read about. A really big defeat for Narendra Modi's party, the BJP, in the state of Karnataka. If you are not familiar with Karnataka, it's because it is a very, very small Indian state, only 60 million people, only two Texases. Yeah, it's India, baby. BJP lost power in the state legislature in the most recent elections and now controls no state governments in the south. And it is widely seen as specifically a repudiation of Modi, who personally held 20 rallies there to try to win the election, and especially of his brand of hardline authoritarian Hindu nationalism, which he and his party have been pushing really, really hard in advance of the elections, because usually that works really well for them in elections, doing things like banning Muslim girls from wearing head coverings in schools, which in the past has been very effective, unfortunately for the BJP, in winning support from Hindus by whipping up sectarian tensions. So probably this is not representative of all of India. Southern India is kind of its own thing in a lot of ways. It's still very popular in the north, but it is a really good sign that at least this big part of India and this big state looked at this model of Hindutva, of extremism that has been gathering so much momentum in India, and said, no, we don't want any more of this.
That's great, especially since not long ago, an Indian court decided to throw in prison or offer a jail sentence to the leading Congress party opposition leader.
Right. Yeah. At a time when so many trends are unfortunately pushing in the wrong direction, it is nice to see Indians pushing back.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. This is working.
Yeah.
This is working.
Loving
on
this,
me.
Right? Loving
like
a little this. Happiness.
I like
yeah.
A little happiness.
Okay. Number four. This one is going to be a little controversial. So I will couch what I mean when I say that this is good news. The United Nations had its first official commemoration of what Palestinians refer to as the Nakba, or the catastrophe, which refers to the 1948, that's 75 years ago, 1948 mass expulsion and departure of 700,000 Palestinians from the territory that is now controlled by Israel. The event itself, I would say, I'm not endorsing in its totality. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, had some things to say that were not so great. But I think it is good, not just for the Palestinians, but frankly also for Israelis, to have recognition of Palestinians' trauma as well as traumas like the Holocaust that led to the creation of Israel. Because not just because I want to see the Palestinians get recognition in itself, although I do, but also because I think that is just important for peace and for moving things forward so that these two peoples can try to understand each other.
You know, I don't get why Israeli officials lobby so hard against events like this. Like, for example, Israel's UN ambassador said, attending this despicable event means destroying any chance of peace by adopting the Palestinian narrative, calling the establishment of the State of Israel a disaster. And I feel like we're kind of getting stuck on an adjective, a description of an event that if you have a little empathy for the individuals involved, if you got pushed out of your home, you would probably feel very badly about that event. the interpretation that's happening here is the suggestion that it's anti-Semitic because it's denying that the state of Israel should exist itself. But what I would
argue—that's not what it means. Yeah,
yeah. I think this is commemorating history,
right?
And that you're destroying any chance of peace by not having peace negotiations.
Right.
I mean, this event isn't going to change any facts on the ground. And I will say with you, Abbas compared some of the Israeli government's rhetoric to Nazis, and that's obviously an insane thing to say
not
and totally
helpful.
Offensive.
Yeah.
And he should stop. He's done that before, and it doesn't help him. It doesn't help the Palestinian people. He hurts his own cause by doing this. But at the same time, like, I don't think any of us should be in the business of denying historical events.
Well, I mean, I think the Israeli, and it's not blanket Israeli opposition, but the Israeli government's opposition to recognizing this is about right of return.
Absolutely.
And as if you acknowledge that that it was bad that 700,000 Palestinians who now have millions of descendants, many of them living in refugee camps in neighboring countries, is bad, then you might have to talk about whether they can come back. And they don't want to have that conversation because they want to maintain a clear Jewish majority in the country.
For sure. It's just such a logical leap to suggest that,
saying
that for an individual who lost their home, that it's bad means we have to acknowledge the right of return.
Right.
It's going to be part of a final status negotiation no matter what, these sort of questions. And the U.S.,
if the negotiation happens.
If it ever happens.
Right.
The U.S., I think opposed the Nakba event and lobbies against these sorts of events at the U.N.
Right.
There was a fight about this in the U.S. Congress. But I'm with you. I think like a little more open and less, we should be able to have these conversations. But
let me actually read a quote to you by that was from the afterword from a book called The Holocaust and the Nakba by two Israeli scholars named Bashir and Amos Goldberg. Unless we can hold these two moments in our hearts and minds as part of the same story, there can be no moving forward in the seemingly unmovable conflict that is Israel-Palestine. So there are Israeli voices calling too for saying, like, let's recognize history.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Okay. Number five in our great, great news list. So the winner of the Thai elections, the leader of that party, the Move Forward Party, that is very likely to become the next Thai prime minister, a guy named Pita Limjaroenrat, is, I'm just going to say it, certified hottie.
How old is he?
That's a good, he's born in 1980.
Okay.
Which is, 42, that's the same year you're
40,
born, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think? He's millennial, right?
Yeah, I am not Gen X. I refuse to be called that, but it's certainly on the later cusp of millennials. Mm-hmm. Some would argue it's well after the cusp. But yeah, I think you know, Gen X on the streets, millennial in the sheets, something like that. I don't know. But I'm glad he's hot. That's great.
I am too. And I should say, we did have a discussion with the head of HR for Crooked Media.
Yeah, yeah.
It was about whether it was okay to say that the next Thai prime minister is hot. And she said that it was. And I'll say, I think this is also good news because I think we could use more hotties in international politics, especially Sana Marin lost office. Although, if you would like a bonus six piece of good news, speaking of Sana Marin, newly single.
Well,
available.
Listen, I'm going to brush right past all this, but it's absolutely true that image and appearance matters in politics. I mean, you know, no one's talking about Mahmoud Abbas.
So am I sullying your podcast?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You're just,
I've always
you're
said that Pod
truth.
Save the World could be a little hornier.
Listen, I Barack Obama certainly benefited for being seen as young and cool and attractive.
The beach picture. That didn't hurt him. Didn't hurt him on the campaign
then there
trail.
Were dad jeans too.
Well, nobody's perfect.
No, nobody's perfect. Well, those were five very hope-filled stories.
Your favorite?
What was my favorite?
I like the Indian elections. I like millions of people coming together to renounce racism and hate. I like that.
Yeah, I think that's really good.
Yeah,
I think that's good. I think the whole Thailand story is really great.
Yeah,
exciting.
Yeah.
Before we end, we did want to encourage listeners to pour one out for the people of Italy, where the government had to call an emergency meeting to address a jump in the price of pasta, which is up 17.5% year over year in March, which is double the average inflation in Italy right now. A Washington Post story about this crisis noted that 60% of Italians eat pasta daily. So take that, paleo diet.
How do they all look so good?
I don't know. I think it's a proportion. I mean, French people,
olive
too.
Oil.
They eat lots of butter and, you know, heavy things. And
so you're saying I should cut it off at 3 pounds of pasta
per meal?
Yeah.
I do think pasta is one of those dishes that at some point people like kind of maybe wrongly bucketed into an unhealthy basket.
I mean, it's all carbs. Fine. It's not. Do you remember when Italy lost in the earthquake? They lost their like national Parmesan reserves. It's rough.
Giant
Italy could use some love here.
They need a break. Yeah. They need a break, and they did just elect a far right prime minister.
Yeah, maybe don't do that, Italy.
Finally, this is a little bit of a spoiler for those who haven't watched this season of Succession. Oh. So turn the podcast off now. But there is a scene where Conor Roy is asked to drop out of the presidential race in exchange for an ambassadorship.
Mm-hmm.
What's he offered? First, Mogadishu?
Oh.
And then he's offered right. the slows?
He said no on the slows. And he goes on this riff. And I have to tell you, I'm kind of impressed with Conor Roy's level of geopolitical and geographic
Absolutely.
Knowledge. He's like making a case for the Koreas, talking about Oman. Like, Conor Roy, maybe a worldo?
Yeah. What do you say? Oman is a poor man's Saudi Arabia or a rich man's
rich
Yemen.
Man's Yemen, yeah. The pearl of Arabia, yeah.
The show is just, it's genius.
And what does he say in the most recent episode? When he's asking for an ambassador, could I get a sniff of a little guy? Organize a little coup down in old Peru. Put me in a van down to Tajikistan, be our fun guy in Uruguay. Tommy, if you had to suspend your $100 million vanity presidential run to accept an ambassadorship, what do you think? Would you be our fun guy down in Uruguay? What country would you ask for?
Peru would be very cool.
Peru would be cool. It's a little messed up these days.
Yeah, it's a little tough. Chile, I think, would be my preference if we were going for regional.
Yeah.
Whoa,
Chile's been having a rough go of it lately, too.
Yeah, but, you know, you got great wine, you got great food, you got a beautiful place.
Yeah, yeah.
Where else? I don't know. Brazil would be great. I mean, post-Bolsonaro.
Man, you're really going for you really want to work.
Well, I'm thinking sort of South America. You want to just be cushy, you could go sort of Caribbean area or, you know, like donor spot in a European capital.
Oh, right. Like with San Marino.
Yeah, or you know, even just sort of any of the big ones.
Yeah.
You know, France, Italy.
Brazil is a good choice. I think the U.S. has been playing a more active role in Brazil, where they really helped with the coup-proofing with the most recent election. I think they're getting tighter with Lula. You're kind of selling me on Brazil. It's also easily one of the most beautiful countries in the world.
Truly. I would love to live in
Brazil. Shout out to Brazil.
Shout out to Brazil and to Conor Roy. And to everyone listening, shout out to Ben, who is probably traveling back right now and maybe listening to this. I think that's all we got for today.
It's a great show.
Tommy Tuberville, you're an idiot.
Can you, on behalf of the Tommy community, renounce the extremism among the Tommies?
Gladly. Gladly. He's got to be one of our worst Tommies.
As a moderate Tommy, don't you, do you feel like you're kind of responsible?
Yeah. And, you know, it's annoying that he was a pretty good football coach.
This is why I'm glad there are no Maxes in politics. Just people's dogs.
There was that guy in New York, Max Rose.
I got there nothing. Oh. The Montana senator, Max?
Baucus.
Baucus, that's right.
He held up Obamacare for months and months.
He's not
months.
So great. Okay. We need a good Max.
Probably a lobbyist. I think we made him ambassador to China.
Really?
Yeah, I know. This shit got weird in the second term. All right, that's all we got for today. Talk to you next week.
All right.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, Ben Rhodes, and Michael Martinez. Our producer is Haley Muse. Our associate producer is Ashley Mizuo. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick, Kyle Seglin, Charlotte Landis, and Vasilis Futopoulos are our sound engineers. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, and Milo Kim, who upload our episodes and videos to YouTube every week. And check out the Pod Save the World YouTube account. Thanks to Saul Rubin for production support. If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, Becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community, is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.